Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, wherever you are in the world. This is a Design for Living Big Book meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. My name is Kathy. I'm a compulsive eater and your chairperson for today. To open the meeting, let us have a moment of quiet meditation followed by the serenity prayer. God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Today, we are delighted to have Barbara joining us to share her experience, strength, and hope on the topic, There is a Solution. Welcome, Barbara.
Hi, I'm Barbara. I'm a compulsive eater. And I'm apparently attending a meeting that starts in Australia, but has gone worldwide. And what an amazing thing it is to be a part of that. Just a couple of points of qualification. I've been a member of Overeaters Anonymous for, it's coming up on 27 and a half years. I attended my first meeting on October 7th, 1995, and my abstinence starts on October 8th, 1995. I went and had my last binge immediately after my first meeting because it was just so comfortable. And I have a sponsor. I sponsor people. I work the 12 steps of Overeaters Anonymous. I use the 9 tools. And I've been invited to incorporate the traditions into my life so that I don't have to harm you with my words or the meeting. So let's talk about There Is a Solution of the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, which I lovingly refer to as the Big Book of Overeaters Anonymous. And if it happens to help a few drunks, good for them. I love the setup of the big book. For someone that might be cynical or new to the program or new to recovery, this feels a little bit like a Ponzi scheme because they don't talk about much of anything except tell the story in chapter one. In chapters two, they still don't tell us what we do, but they're still like inviting us in, you know, and it's real easy peasy. And then when we get to chapter three, well, wait, you're still talking about alcoholism. You're not telling me what it is I have to do. And then it's not till chapter four that they start getting down to the proverbial meat and potatoes. But coming back to There Is a Solution. There exists among us a fellowship of friendliness and an understanding which is indescribably wonderful. I love the fact that part of the solution that they initially talk about is the fellowship. It is where I find identification. It is where I hear that you ate out of a garbage can. You stole food from your secretary. You denied food to your kids because you took it. The eating, hiding and eating in the bathroom. And they talk about how, you know, I always say about the captain's table, the steerage, I'll sit in meetings with people and I'll have no idea what their job was, what their career was, what their political leanings are, what kind of home do they live in or do they not live in a home? Are they married? Are they straight? Are they gay? I don't know anything about them except that they suffered and did things with food that brought the misery, and that we've shared that at the meetings. And I can talk with them for hours and I can listen to them for hours as a result. Captain's table to steerage. It doesn't matter who you are or what you are. This is what the beginning of this chapter tells us, that we have this common peril, this common embarrassment, which turns into our strength, this common horrid feeling about ourselves, the self-loathing that becomes the strength when it's with more than one person and we can share it. And it goes on to say that it is the powerful cement which binds us. And I will share with you that that is the experience that I've had over these past 27 years. When I look at the quality of my life now and how it shows up on a daily basis, the majority of my friends that I travel with, or go and do fun things with are all, are 75% of them are in recovery and working the 12 steps of fill in the blank. And it binds us together. We know each other's love language, the language of the heart. And for this, I'm tremendously grateful, which leads me to the last paragraph on the first page of this chapter. The tremendous fact for every one of us is that, and I'm going to put some emphasis on the word, on a word here. Every one of us is that we have discovered a common solution. We have a way out. We can absolutely agree upon which we can join in brotherly and harmonious action. I'm a person that has pounded the table about the first word of the first step, which is we. And in my experience, it has become as important as the word God or higher power, because I find my higher power in the we sometimes. When I'm lost, when I'm not connected as I have been in my life spiritually, the we is where I get reconnected. Because whenever there's two of us together, it's a meeting. Every time, it's a meeting. And that is a beautiful description. That paragraph is a beautiful description of the fellowship. I love how in the next page, it goes right into telling, it tells us whether we're just coming into the rooms of Overeaters Anonymous, or it helps us keep the memory green, which is so important because I shouldn't forget where I've come from and what it was like 28 years ago, because it was miserable and I was unhappy. I'm maintaining about a 60 to 65 pound weight loss, and I was nothing but angry. I was angry all the time. And I was eating all the time. And I had a very high level professional job in a very public space. I was a deputy district attorney in the capital city of California. And I weighed over 225 pounds. I had to wear skirts to court. And the only way I could keep them connected was with a big baby diaper pin underneath my jacket and my silk blouse that I was sweating through constantly. And I had to appear in front of a jury or in front of a judge. And hopefully you just looked at me from here up, because the rest of me was not worthy. And this next paragraph talks about what the alcoholic illness, what the compulsive eating illness brought to us, the annihilation of all things worthwhile in life. And how it touches everyone else in our lives. Misunderstanding, fierce resentment, financial insecurity, disgusted friends, disgusted employers, warped lives of our children, warped lives of our sad spouses, and warped lives of our parents. All of the wreckage of our past. Somebody coming into these rooms, or somebody questioning whether that they're a compulsive eater or not, they read that and they go, oh, yeah, that, yeah, that. It is the this is what the disease of compulsive eating had brought me before I came in. And I will tell you, on occasion, even in recovery, I have gotten a few of these things back, because I don't know if any of you have done it perfectly. If you have, can I get your number? I haven't. And there's nothing worse than having to make amends for behavior while in recovery. It's not that it's worse, it's just hard, especially if you have any amount of an ego like I do. And I love the humility that how this message is brought to us in this chapter. We hope this volume will inform and comfort those who are or may be affected. So maybe if you're an alcoholic, maybe this book will work. If you're a compulsive eater. It goes on to say that there's a speaker in AA whose name is Willie B. from Sprang, Texas. I think she has passed. She had tall hair. She was, you know, higher the hair, closer to God kind of gal. And she would talk about the squiggly writing. And if it was squiggly writing, it was very important. And we have squiggly writing on page 18 about the X problem eater who has found, the solution, who is properly armed with the facts about themselves. It's an important sentence because I have in the past been a two-stepper and a 12-stepper. And, you know, when I was in the first step, I thought I could go cure everyone because I was suddenly abstinent for, 30 days. But I wasn't properly armed with the facts about myself. I hadn't worked all of the steps. I hadn't even done step four. And I needed to be properly armed with the steps. Now, I could talk to newcomers, and that was great. And we became a sisterhood of recovery as we walked through the steps. How do we win the entire confidence of another compulsive eater? Well, I don't know how many of you have experienced this, but you're sitting in your doctor's office and your doctor says, Barbara, you need to lose some weight. I do? I'm shocked to hear that. Of course I know that. Or, a family member says, Barbara, don't you want to lose weight so that your knees don't hurt so bad? Of course I do. But these are people that don't necessarily understand the disease of compulsive eating. And so it's when another compulsive eater, armed with the facts about themselves, talking to another one and saying, yeah, I ate out of the garbage too. Oh yeah, I know how to pick up 3 donuts at a time and go eat them in the bathroom at work and then come out and be surprised at all the donuts that were delivered. People will nod their heads and understand. Much like we heard about it in Bill's story when Evie Thatcher came and talked to Bill and said that he was sober, and Evie drank more than Bill did. And Bill's looking at him going, dude's got something going on. I don't know if I want it, but he's got something going on. We as compulsive eaters can carry that message in compulsive eaters in recovery. And oftentimes the message can't be carried by a medical professional because they don't understand the disease. They can send us to OA or suggest it or recommend it, but it's only when we get in the meeting and other people understand that we feel safe and that we feel okay. When we move on to page 19 in the first full paragraph, I like how it's still the we, it's those first 100 alcoholics that were writing this story. We feel that the elimination of our eating is but a beginning. A much more important demonstration of our principles lies before us in our respective homes, occupations, and affairs. Well, that's disturbing. You mean if I don't just stop eating, my life won't get automatically better? They're being very honest here when they write this to tell us, look, you're going to stop eating. You're going to have a lot of feelings. Your behaviors are still going to be cockeyed. And it's the beginning to stop solving everything with food. And we're here to talk to you about the demonstration of the principles in all the aspects of your life. And we may have some answers for you, but they don't tell you yet. Again, I see this whole string where they keep pulling me along in this book and want me to read the next chapter. They want me to read the next paragraph. Well written from a sales standpoint, I just got to say. And then they're very clear at the bottom of page 19 about the purpose of the big book. We publish this anonymous volume, setting forth a problem, not as it is, but as we see it, as our experiences. We shall begin, bring to the task our combined experience and knowledge. I love the fact that we share experience, strength, and hope. I've been known to share my opinion quite a bit. Not necessarily experience, strength, and hope. And I like it. I don't like it when I'm called on it, but I appreciate it when I'm called on it. That this should suggest a useful program for anyone concerned with an eating problem, a drinking problem. You can fill in the blank problem, these 12 steps are going to be useful, but they haven't really talked about the 12 steps yet. What are they talking about? Again, they keep us interested. I'm pausing because the bottom of page 19 and page 20 is one of the most difficult and challenging things in my life. Most of us sense that real tolerance of other people's shortcomings and viewpoints and a respect for their opinions are attitudes which make us more useful to others. And then the next sentence, our very lives as ex-problem eaters depend upon our constant thought of others and how we may help meet their needs. Excuse me, it's about me. I'm the one with the big butt. I'm the one that can't stop eating. What do you mean I have to pay it? So do I only have to be nice to the people in OA? Is that what they're saying? No. And this is, you know, I got to behave really well in OA meetings. My challenge was, how was I going to be in constant thought of others and how could I help meet their needs outside of the rooms of OA? And that's where I was growing exponentially. If you can imagine, my career at that time was about being right, superior, judgmental, argumentative, and did I mention superior? And here I was being asked to be in constant thought of others and how may I help meet their needs, not get over on somebody. So this was the beginning of some significant change for me. And I'm really glad that the first 100 alcoholics put this in here because it's a big sentence. I have to tolerate your shortcomings and your viewpoints? Really? Well, maybe if I just don't ask you what they are, then I can tolerate you, which is what I did for a very long time. Because I didn't suffer idiots well. Mm-mm. I had snappy answers to stupid questions frequently in my life. So this part of the there is a solution. They're telling us or giving us a heads up that there's some what I refer to as PhD work, lifetime work that's going to happen. You know, when you go to the middle of page 20, it says all of those questions. You know, why couldn't you stop drinking? Don't you love your spouse enough? Maybe you should just quit eating that. Maybe you could stop if you wanted to. I think as compulsive eaters, you and I both know that that's happy hoo-ha. Self-will has never brought us to a place of happiness, joy, or freedom, or peace, ever. You know, why don't you just have one cookie, Barbara? What? That's like stupid, right? One? But we all know, for everyone has their own plan. In a way, it can be, you know, one is too many and 100's not enough, which is similar to alcohol. Or it could be that I would, you know, once I start throwing up, I'm always going to throw up. Once I start restricting, it just grows exponentially. The idea for me that I could maybe have one fill in the blank that I haven't had for 27 years, I probably could eat one. But I have no idea what's going to happen the next day. Because as we heard in the doctor's opinion, and we heard in Bill's story, the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind, when I start getting into the debate club about what I can do and what I can't do with food, and I don't invite my higher power in, these questions start coming up for me in the middle of page 20. My life depends truly upon helping others. Meetings, reading, meetings, read. And the thing that I think it tells me more than anything else in this chapter is the old saying, I can't sit in a chicken coop and expect to become a chicken. I can't sit in an OA meeting and expect to become abstinent and in recovery. I'll tell you, I think sitting in an OA meeting and not working the steps makes eating miserable. I think it makes eating miserable. A belly full of food with a head full of OA. I don't want to be in that place. I think it becomes miserable. There is a solution, goes on and talks about the different kinds of drinkers. And we have all the different kinds of eaters. We have everything from restriction to purging to weekend binge eating, to only nighttime eating, to I know that when I became abstinent, See's Candy here in California and Ben and Jerry's ice cream took a hit in their profit margin. As a matter of fact, they wanted to do an investigation and wonder what happened. That woman in California stopped eating all this stuff and we're not making as much money. Everybody has the thing that makes them their compulsive eater. And this chapter talks about all of the different ways that we obsessively think or act around food or food behaviors. And it covers both all of that. It's not just the food, it's the food behaviors. I was Meals on Wheels. I live alone and I would still hide the wrappers at the bottom of the garbage in case company came over and looked. I ate in the bathrooms. I ate without utensils. I ate standing at the counter with my raincoat on. And I'm the only one that lived in my house and I was afraid I wasn't going to get enough. So I had food behaviors and I had food. And this chapter, again, tries to reach out to all the different types of alcoholics so that it's a big circus tent. Everybody gets to come to this circus. Doesn't matter what you do with your food. And everyone wants to know, you know, in this chapter, it says, I want to know why I'm a compulsive eater. And it says, perhaps there will never be a full answer to these questions. Well, that's disappointing because I'm sure if I knew why, I could stop. It's not an intellectual problem. It's a spiritual problem. And they're introducing that to us in this chapter. There is a solution. The spiritual condition controls the mind. We know that while the alcoholic keeps away from drink, as he may do for many months or years, he reacts much like other men. We're equally positive that once he takes any alcohol, whatever, into his system, something happens, both in the bodily and mentally sense, which makes it virtually impossible for him to stop. The experience of any alcoholic will abundantly confirm this. When I reframe that language into a compulsive eater, I reflect upon my friends in a way that were abstinent for 8, 9, 10 years and then relapsed and put weight back on and kept coming and trudging to meetings and shaking their fists on why. And we know why. And they suggest to it here, and they're coming to it. It's about the spiritual condition that we have to have to maintain our recovery and to maintain my abstinence today. You know, I'm a firm believer in humor because I can take life way too seriously. And, you know, there's people that new friends I'll make, oh, you know, Barbara, don't you ever have dessert ever? And I said, no. And they go, well, how long? And I'll say, you know, whatever, 27 years. And I go, but why can't you have just one? Oh, I said, I'm allergic. And they said, what happens? What's your allergic reaction? I said, my butt swells. And you know what? They get it when you say that. My butt gets bigger. Now, I don't tell them about how I'm going to become a vicious, sharp-tongued critic and judger of their life, their behavior, their words, and their thoughts, because I suddenly become able to hear their thoughts. It is only when I maintain some semblance of a spiritual connection that I can be connected with my friends. If I don't have the spiritual connection, I'm a quasi-grandma of 3 kids. I forgot to have children. My career got crazy, blah, blah, blah. But these 3 kids are in my life, and I have a drawer in my kitchen. It's filled with candy and none of it is mine and I'm not attracted to it. I am here to tell you that if I don't get on my knees every morning, have a fit spiritual connection every day, burpees with God, I call it some days, burpees with God. And I will be looking in that candy drawer to see what I might be able to have. What piece of candy in there may have some protein? I'll start having that debate. I've gone astray. Let's come back to there is a solution. The book also talks about the intellectual approach, the academic approach, and talks about how the main problem of the alcoholic centers in their mind rather than their body. And if you ask them why they started the last bender or the last binge, they will offer you any of 100 reasons. My dog died. My spouse left me. I lost my job. I got a hangnail. The sun came up. It rained. Sometimes these excuses have a certain plausibility, but none of them make sense. None of them make sense based on what we know, what food will do to me if it takes me back over. You know, they get pretty simple in describing the insanity. It's like the man having the headache and then he beats himself with a hammer so that he can't feel the ache anymore. And that's what we do with food. I ate the food to take care of the anxiety, the self-loathing, the whatever feeling I was having. And it lasted for 15 seconds until my butt grew some more. And then I was more angry at myself and at you because you caused me to eat. I ate it. So I'm mad at me. I'm mad at you. I'm mad at the world. And that's the insanity of doing it over and over again. They have a little paragraph here about Al-Anoners. I think I'll share. At the bottom of 23, how true this is, if you realize, in a vague way, their families or friends sense that these drinkers are abnormal, but everybody hopefully awaits the day when the sufferer, us, me, will rouse myself from my lethargy and assert my power of will. That's the little token paragraph for the Al-Anoners, right? And that's for our family members who look at us. And so you have such a beautiful face. If you would just lose weight, Barbara. Oh, yeah. I don't even want to tell you how many times I heard that sentence. And the tragic truth is, if you're a real alcoholic, if you're a real compulsive eater, the happy day may not arrive because we've lost control. So again, this chapter is talking to us about self-control and how it hasn't worked. At a certain point in the drinking of the eating of every compulsive eater, they pass into a state where the most powerful desire to stop is what? Of absolutely no avail. Why me? Why me? Why me? And the real question is, why not you? Why not you, Barbara? Why not you? The fact is, squiggly writing again, I'm channeling Willie B. The fact is that most alcoholics, for reasons yet obscure, have lost the power of choice. I lost the power of choice when it came to boxes of candy, cookies, anything that was a dessert food. Our so-called willpower becomes practically non-existent. We were unable at certain times to bring into our consciousness with sufficient force the memory of the suffering and humiliation of the last binge, whether it was yesterday, last week, last month. If I don't remember it, I'm just doomed to repeat it. We are without a defense against the first compulsive bite. I remember I got a birthday card. I'm lucky enough to be a double winner. Found that out after I came to OA. I was drinking with most every meal. Very disturbing. Anyway, I got this card from a 40-year sober woman, and she put a nickel, a penny, a dime, and a quarter in it and taped it. And she said, keep the memory green and don't forget to change. That's what the old timers used to do. And it just reminds it, this squiggly line paragraph is the one for me at 27 years to never forget what the last binge was like. How I felt, how my gut hurt, how my head hurt, all of it, and how I was unavailable for anybody. The next paragraph, the almost certain consequences that follow the first bite do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted or replaced with the old threadbare, worn-out ideas that this time, it'll be okay. I'll just have one. There is a complete failure of the kind of defense that keeps one from putting his hand on a hot stove. It's such a perfect analogy. I don't know. I get blisters on my hand. I'm not going to go and touch that against my, I'm going to stand an extra foot away. But I will walk to the package of cookies to see what they're like, what do they smell like, and I can have one. And it never worked that way. One handful, one package, thought that was a serving. It won't burn me this time. And that's how I used to be. I could diet, I could lose the 30 pounds and put on the 50. I could lose the 10, put on the 30. I always got the bonus plan after dieting. This time it'll be different. And it goes on to say at the bottom of page 24, with this sort of, when this sort of thinking is fully established in someone with our tendencies, they'll probably place themselves beyond human aid unless locked up, may die, or go permanently insane. Now, is that an overstatement? There's a parable that says, you know, one alcoholic was talking to another, one compulsive, and he said, you know, there's three choices here. You can die, diabetes, cardiovascular disease, you can die. You can end up in a mental health hospital or in a nursing home because your knees don't work. They can't do the surgery. You're so overweight and you got water on your lungs. So you can be institutionalized, or you can go to a spiritual program and live a life beyond your wildest dreams. Which one do you want to choose? And being the very smart, compulsive eaters that we are, or that I am, my response is, let me think about it. Death, institutions, or happy, joyous, and free? Let me think about it. Because the concept of following a spiritual life of any sort, yeah, that just sounds woo-woo. That just sounds too woo-woo. And this is what they're introducing to us in There Is a Solution. So very slowly. Because the next sentence, but for the grace of God, there would have been thousands more convincing demonstrations. So many want to stop, but cannot. And then we have the magic phrase. There is a solution. Okay, they're finally getting to the point. Where's the pill I take? What are the three things I need to do to be successful? Come on, let's get to it. Instant gratification. Oh, this isn't good. Almost none of us like the self-searching, the leveling of our pride, and the confession of shortcomings, which the process doesn't say suggest. It says requires for successful consummation. But we saw it really worked in others. So they're saying something here without telling us that you're going to have to work the steps. We haven't told you about them yet. We're giving you some general descriptors. Don't run away. But you're going to have to level your pride. You're going to have to do some self-evaluation. You're going to have to confess my shortcomings. I'm sure there's not that many. But we saw it worked in others. And there's the identification part. Identification with hope. And we come to believe that the hopelessness and futility of life that we had, as we had been living it, would leave. It worked in others. We were approached by those with whom the problem had been solved. I got to tell you, when I got to hear people had been in program for a period of time and had maintained a weight loss and were happy at work and had spouses that they were connected to and their children were talking to them, and they had family lives up and down the family tree, I'm kind of going, well, maybe. We had to pick up the simple kit of spiritual tools laid at our feet. And here's the hope. I'm so glad they have identification and hope. We have found much of heaven, and we have been rocketed into the fourth dimension of existence, of which we had not even dreamed. And I got to tell you, in 1995, if I had read this, I wouldn't have understood it. I would have said, this is hippie talk. It's woo-woo. You see, I'm from the Northeast. I'm from Maine. Pull yourself up by your bootstraps. Layer your clothing in the winter. It's all going to be good. Don't tell people your problems. rocketed into the fourth dimension. That must be California talk, as far as if I had read that the first time through. The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have a deep and we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences. Oh my God, there's an asterisk. I have to go to the back of the book. I don't want to. I never read footnotes, appendixes, they're a problem. They don't tell us to go there. They just put it there in case you're curious. And it's a good curious. We're not going to go into it today, but it's a good curious. Go and check it out. The spiritual experience, which what? Revolutionized. That's an awfully big word to describe the word changed. Changed our whole attitude towards life, towards our fellows, and towards, they're starting to say God a lot more. God's universe. They're not telling me I have to believe it, but my attitude might have to change. The central facts today is the absolute certainty. Now they're getting a little bit more directive, that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do by ourselves, the spiritual condition. And it goes on to say, there's no debate, there's no negotiation. Listen, if you're only a little bit alcoholic or a little bit of a compulsive eater, this may not be for you. But if you are seriously a compulsive eater, as we are, we believe there's no middle of the road solution. We're in a position where life was becoming impossible. And we had but two alternatives: to go on to the bitter end, doing it our way, best we could, or the other was to accept spiritual help. You know, this goes back to the parable of death, institutions, or spiritual help. Let me think about it. You know, the concept that I might have to do that is very disturbing. The next two pages really talk about Roland Hazard, which has got a very strong historical component of how AA came about. Some of you may really know this, and some of you may not. But for Roland Hazard, Ebbie Thatcher probably would not have gotten sober. Ebbie Thatcher would not have gotten sober. He wouldn't have gone to see Bill Wilson. Bill Wilson would never have run into Dr. Bob. And we might not have had this, as has been explained to me. Roland Hazard was a well-off man, and he was a drunk, bad drunk. He went across the ocean to go find Dr. Young. And he said, fix me. I got to stop this. And Dr. Young worked with him. He stopped drinking and he was feeling better. He thought he had it all figured out, the inner workings of his mind. And so he goes back home all by himself and he drinks. And he gets to misery quickly. It's a lot like a diet, I think. And he goes back over the ocean and he says, please, you've got to tell me what's wrong with me. You've got to tell me. In the doctor's judgment, he was utterly hopeless. He could never regain his position aside. He'd have to place himself under lock and key or hire a bodyguard if he expected to live long. That was the great Dr. Young's opinion. Money can't buy you the answer you want. And so Roland Hazard let his ego step aside and he said, you've got to tell me what is wrong with me. You have the mind of a chronic alcoholic, chronic compulsive eater. I have never seen one single case recover where the state of mind existed to the extent it does in you. Holy crap. Is there no exception? Yes. Exceptions occur. And they've happened before, here and there, once in a while. I love it. Here and there, once in a while. Alcoholics have had what are called, here we go again, the vital spiritual experience. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of a huge emotional displacement and rearrangement. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes, which were once the guiding forces are suddenly cast to one side and completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. I've been trying to do that with you, Roland. It hasn't worked. I have never been successful with an alcoholic of your description. Oh my goodness, there's that asterisk again. Gosh, they're being persistent. Go and look at it, Barbara, in Appendix 2. Upon hearing this, he was relieved and reflected that after all, I go to church. I'm a good church member. I put money in the bucket. I kneel when I'm supposed to kneel. I stand when I'm supposed to stand. It's all good. My religious convictions will help me. And he found out that that's not what it was about. It wasn't about the religious convictions. It's an important story about an intelligent man with pride and ego being told, nothing about your intellect will help you. Nothing about your money will help you. You will need a vital spiritual experience, a shift and a change. And you know, Roland went back across the way with this information, a little demoralized, more than a little. And that's when he got connected up, I think it was with the Washingtonians or the Oxford group. And that's where everything started to develop. And that's where the birthplace, the idea started to conjure up about AA and the 12-step program, as it's been taught to me. So we, in our turn, sought the same escape with all the desperation of drowning men. I don't know if any of you have had the experience of almost drowning. I have. I was 17 years old. I was at a basketball camp just before my senior year. We went out in the lake. We're all great swimmers. And a gal was drowning. She wasn't a good swimmer. I had lifeguard experience. I started swimming back and I knew I had to wait for her to go down before I get her because she'll grab me and take me down with her. And she felt where I was in the water. She found me, wrapped her legs around me, pushed me down in the water to get up. I had to bite her to get her off of me so that I could save myself. I couldn't get away from her fast enough. The next time she wrapped her legs around my neck, pushed me down to get up. And I don't remember anything except being brought to shore and having my back slapped to get the water out of me. But I know what a drowning person will do to save themselves. We in turn sought the same escape with all the desperation of that drowning person. What seemed at first a flimsy reed is proven to be the loving and powerful hand of God. A new life has been given us, or if you prefer, a design for living that really works. If I remain desperate enough, even at 27 years, to be on my knees every morning, to show up at my meetings, to have a service position, to sponsor people in OA, my flimsy reed will be a loving and powerful hand of God. And I tie that in from this chapter. For someone with time, it's important. If you're walking in the rooms, read it as it is. If you've been in the rooms, maybe read it as I just spoke. It goes on to talk about the varieties of religious experience. Now they've given us the asterisk twice, and now they're talking about this book. They're really bringing up the whole spiritual religious thing. Indicates the many ways in which people have discovered God. I love the fact they make it a broad, open highway for us to come. And I think I'm at about 5 minutes now, if I'm not mistaken. Good job. We have many different ways to find your higher power. We have no desire to and they go on to say, we have no desire to tell you what way you should do this. There are not to convince anyone that there is only one way by which faith can be acquired. Can you imagine if you came in and I told you, you had to believe in this in order to get abstinent? This must be your higher power. Well, first of all, the majority of you would leave the room. There's a couple of people who would stay to see if they needed to call 5150, help. But when they wrote this chapter, they were so brilliant, so God-inspired, so grace-driven. There is no one way by which faith can be acquired. If what we have learned and felt and seen means anything at all on page 28, it means that all of us, whatever, this is written in 1935. Let's pay attention to this. Whatever our race, creed, or color, are the children of a living creator with whom we may form a relationship upon simple and understandable terms as soon as we are willing. What's the only condition? Willing and honest enough to try. That's the only condition. And that if you have a religion and a faith practice, there's nothing here that will disturb that. They don't want friction. They don't have an opinion. We have no opinion about what religious bodies or how they identify. It's not our concern. It's an entirely personal affair. I love that they talk us about spirituality. We all mistake it for religious. And you've heard the saying, religion is for the people that are afraid to go to hell, and spirituality is for those that have been to hell and just don't want to go back. That's what our program is. That's what Overeaters Anonymous is. And then it's really very nice at the end here. The following chapter, they give us a little entree, coming previews, appears an explanation of alcoholism as we understand it. Well, there's even more. And then the chapter to the agnostic, which I think is brilliant. We're not talking about it today, though. Many who are in this class are now our members. So it's a little hook. Okay, I know you're an agnostic or an atheist. It's okay. Well, we got a few of you coming in. You might want to read on. On the last page, on page 29, the first full paragraph, further on, clear-cut directions are given. That's the 12 steps. Starts in how it works. They're given showing how we recovered. These are followed by all the stories. Each individual in the stories writes about their own point of view, the way they established their relationship with a higher power. And then they get very humble at the end. Hope we haven't been too self-revealing. Hope it hasn't been in bad taste here. But we think there's a lot of men and women that desperately need what we have. And we believe it can only be done by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems so that I can say, yes, I'm one of you. I must have this thing. I am Barbara. I am a compulsive eater, and I need this thing. Thanks for having me today.
Thank you, Barbara, so much for sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us today. It was great. We will now be transitioning into a question and answer segment, and I'd like to introduce Joanne, who is our moderator for today. Joanne.
Hi, thank you so much, Barbara. Thank you to everyone who has been sending your questions in the chat. My name is Joanne. I am a compulsive overeater. One of the first questions we have here, you mentioned you are a double winner. How do you work two programs thoroughly? And is being an overeater a deeper experience than with alcohol?
So the gift that I have is that I came into OA first, as I mentioned, and then 3 months later came into AA. I have two sponsors, two women kicking my butt. Fun. I have sponsees in both programs. I go to meetings in both. And I will be honest with you, I'll share at a meeting. And I don't share if it's about food or a longing for alcohol. I'm really talking about life's challenges, and I'm talking about my character defects for the most part in the meetings. And people don't know if I'm talking from an OA perspective or an AA perspective. I'm talking from a 12-step recovery perspective. I am of the opinion that the OA 12 and 12 fourth step questions are the perfect colonoscopy that anybody should do to do a thorough fourth step. I have been gifted to sponsor double winners, women, angry women coming into OA from AA, angry women. And they've had the gift of doing a fourth step in OA utilizing those questions and just going deeper. And the comments and experience that I hear from them is that this was a much, not that it was better, it was deeper. And they became even more aware of what they were doing, how they were doing it, where those feelings came from. So I hope that answers you for you.
Thank you. Thank you, Barbara. The next question that I have here on the list, in your experience, Barbara, how are emotional and spiritual recovery linked? How are they different? Emotional recovery versus spiritual recovery. Is there something going on there?
You know, our recovery, it's my understanding, my experience, my recovery is a three-legged stool, physical, emotional, and spiritual. As a matter of fact, I wear, just to let you know so that I never forget, I wear three rings on my finger all the time to remember that it's physical, spiritual, and emotional. And if one, if I'm really focused on my plan of eating and my exercise, my plan of action, and I'm not doing, taking care of my spiritual life, or I'm not addressing the feelings that I'm feeling with regard to an event, then my stool becomes tipped. And when it's tipped, it means I can fall into the food. Or what happens to me first before I'll eat? I think this is my experience. I know it's my experience. I will fall into some really nasty behaviors. I will rip your head off verbally. I will take your inventory like that. So I see all three of those components to be equal. The spiritual one component is so important, but if I never address the emotional, the feelings that I'm having, and I don't bring those feelings to my higher power, I'm going to have a short leg there. If I think I'm going to make all these changes in my plan of eating and how I eat, when I eat, where I eat, why I eat, but never bring it to my higher power and to my sponsor, it's going to become Barbara's will. There's another saying, you know, in my life, if I make a decision to go forward and do something, if it starts off real easy and then gets hard later on, it was Barbara's will. If it starts off hard and challenging and then becomes easy, then I know it was my higher power's will. I don't know that that necessarily answers your question, but I do think that they're bound together, all three of them, physical, emotional, and spiritual, in such a way that you can't separate them out, and that I have to give them all equal time. And the easiest one to not give equal time to is my spiritual life. I'll cut that 5 minutes of meditation down to two because, you know, I got to go play golf. Really, Barb? So that's my experience. And I know that the restless irritability and discontent will show up. And I'll make a commitment to you guys. Actually, I've been debating it for 2 days and I shouldn't be debating it. I need to call my sponsor and say, I am off the beam a little bit. I feel it. I don't feel connected to my higher power. So I'm going to call her. Okay. I just told 71 people I'm going to do that. Jeez. So I know that I need to do, I don't know what it is I need to do. Barbara can't fix Barbara right now. So there you go.
Yeah. Thank you. Thank you, Barbara. Next question is about daily practice. You talk about doing burpees in the morning with your higher power. Could you briefly kind of talk about that, the mechanics? What do you do in the morning?
Absolutely. Since the day I've been abstinent, which was the day after my first meeting, I've made my bed every day. And I consider that a spiritual act because when I left home at 18 until the day, I only made my bed if company was coming over. So I make my bed and then I'm immediately on my knees. I put a pillow down and I'm on my knees. And here's what my prayer is in the morning to start my day. And I heard this in my home group this morning. I wake up untreated. I wake up an untreated compulsive eater. So I'm on my knees and my hands are like this. They're not like this. They're palms up and extended because every morning my higher power delivers to me the gift of abstinence. Sometimes it's in a nice little package, well wrapped, sometimes got a big bow, sometimes it's a plain brown wrapper. But the gift is at the edge of my bed every day. And it's my job to put my hand out. I can't grab it. I can't squeeze it. I have to hold it. And my prayer in that moment is that I treat this gift of abstinence with grace and dignity all day today. And then I say the third step prayer. And then I have to have coffee. But after that, it's a matter of, there's some readings that I do. I use the Four Today. I use the Voices of Recovery, and I use the AA Daily Reader. And I pause after that. And I have a little bit of a, I call it a scrolling addiction. I don't know if anyone else suffers from it, where I should be looking at something important on my phone. And I try to pause before all that happens. And I have a lovely view in my backyard. I have a dog who has been sitting by for the entire session today. And we just have quiet time in the morning. And that's how I have to begin my day. If not, y'all are screwed. You're all going to pay the price initially. I'll pay the price secondarily and finally, but you'll pay it all in how I treat you. So that's burpees with God in the morning, because some days I don't want to get on my knees.
Yeah, thank you so much. Another question, how do you stay focused on thinking of others and how to help them without crossing the line into codependency or Al-Anon type fixing issues?
Oh, absolutely. Actually, no is a complete sentence. I'm really good at that. So someone will say, hey, Barbara, can you la, 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 la to do something? If it's open on my schedule, I'll say yes. If it's not, I'm not going to move things. I'll say no. But I think I think the helping others and being useful to others is a little bit less than the doing. I often think it's about being present for someone else, in my experience. It's picking the phone up when the call comes. It's getting a voicemail and returning the call. Gosh dang, I got to tell you how much I don't like texts because it's not human. I mean, I want to hear you or to see you and hear you. I'm big on that. And but it's to return the text timely to somebody. They're saying, hey, you know what? My refrigerator's calling to me and I got another 2 hours until dinner. So I'm making an outreach call, and I respond back. And it's usually someone I know well, so I'll be a bit snarky. No, this was a reach out text, not a call. How about you give me a call right now? And then they pick up the phone and call me. That was a snarky kindness thing right there. I don't suggest it. That's Barbara Snark. But I think it's sometimes we think that making a phone call or listening on the phone call means I have to invest an hour, and I don't. Sometimes all I have to do is listen, or I'll pick up and say, hey, I'm 5 minutes from going into an appointment. What's going on? Talk to me. And we talk and they tell me what's going on. I said, that sounds hard. I'm not there to fix them. I may get to say, what do you want to do about this? Is there anything you should do today or in this moment? No. Okay. Well, I think you got your answer then. You know what? The vending machine thinks I should have a fill in the blank. And I said, and I'll say, well, it's always been my experience to go walk 2 flights of stairs and see if the vending machine is talking to me, or if it's nice outside, go walk around the block. A distraction moment. Or if I'm sitting there, I say, you want me to pull my Four Today out and read you what it says? I do not have to be creative. I do not have to fix them. Sometimes it's just, I know what it felt like to be heard, just to be heard in the moment. That sounds hard. We don't fix each other, we support each other. So the altruism, I do things for people, or I answer the phone expecting nothing in return. And that's what altruism is. And that's what they talked about in the doctor's opinion a couple times. hope that gives you some thoughts about what I think about it, my experience.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Barbara. We've got a question here from a member around slipping and sliding. What is the difference between a slip, a slide, a bust? And you mentioned having years and years of recovery. How do you define abstinence and how do you walk that line?
Well, I use the OA definition, the action of refraining from compulsive eating while maintaining or working towards a normal body weight with food and around food behaviors. Okay, here we go. I'm just going to give you the short thumbnail version of Barbara's 27 years. When I started in OA, I was eating from the time I woke up until I fell asleep in bed. I brought food with me and I just ate all the time whenever I could. So when I started in OA, I don't know why I got this idea, but it wasn't dessert foods that I had to stop eating. It wasn't sugar or sweets. It was dessert foods, because otherwise I was just going to find a lot of loopholes. I would eat fat-free, frozen, sugar-free, fill in the blank, right? So I knew I had heard 3 meals a day with life in between 1 day at a time at my very first meeting, where they were talking about the 11th step was experience. Anyway, so I said, okay, I'm going to do 3 meals a day. I'm going to do a snack and I'm not going to eat dessert foods. And that's what the first year and a half was like for me. And then, you know, an event happened in my life, and I was at a Super Bowl party with a bunch of alcoholics, and I drank 5 Diet Dr. Peppers, ended up with a pain in my head, thought for sure it was a brain tumor, said I promise never to drink sodas again, because I know I had a brain tumor. I didn't. And so things started to change. My plan of eating became a little bit more narrow over time. After a 6-month debate with God, and I was winning up until the end, by the way, no more flour, no more flour, because I had no idea what a single serving of pasta was. When I put the little circle up against the side of the box, I said, that's an appetizer. Who are you kidding? You know, cereal was dieter's ice cream for me. It was so problematic. And so I said, it's on you, God. If you don't want me to eat flour, you do it. Because there's a great story behind it. I don't think we have time for it, but that first day, it was an entire God thing. I had no bagels in the house. I couldn't have my regular breakfast. Lunch, the deli was overrun because of a big protest outside the courthouse. They didn't have any bread left. And that night, the menu at the restaurant I went to stuck together, the pasta ones and the appetizers, and it just opened up to entrees. And so I had an entree without any bread or pasta or anything. How that happened is, you know, it's a God thing. And I said, you think you're so smart to God. And he was. And then things have changed since then. And the past 5 years have been about a swear word. Some of you may be familiar with it. It's called moderation. Painful. Very painful, moderate amounts, and actually using a measuring cup to see what, do I really think this is a half a cup of fill in the blank? And I was pretty close. Of course, mine were rounded. And so these past 5 years, maybe more like 7 years, has been about moderation within my plan of eating, which is 3 meals a day, a snack, 1 day at a time, life in between. No dessert foods. And, you know, do I have slips on moderation? I just came back from a week's vacation at an all-inclusive resort for all you can eat and all you can drink. Yeah, moderation was a challenge. I had to pray before every meal. I had to know what my last bite was going to be before my first bite. That's the only way, because I was traveling with 3 non-recovered women. God bless them. They can eat with impunity. What do you mean you're only eating half the dessert? Damn it. You know, it was so interesting to watch old behaviors come out of me, old thinking. What do you mean it's too rich? What? But the way I did it was I had to know what my last bite was before I took my first bite. And that was a spiritual act. I would say I had an 80-20 success rate, which is pretty good on the corporate level for success, 80-20. There were some days my portions were too big and I could feel it in my body. Did I come back abstinent? Absolutely. The concepts of slips, slides, sloshes, bloshes, all those words, it's not for me to comment on. That is a God sponsor, sponsee comment, discussion. That's a level of honest writing for yourself that you bring to your higher power and your sponsor, and you pray about it. This isn't a diet and calories club. It isn't. This is a design for living of freedom. My plan of eating has to fit like one of my favorite comfortable jackets or sweatshirts. The kind that I just want to tool around in the day and just feel all good. That's what my plan of eating has to be for me. I don't know if that's helpful, but that helps me to have said that out loud.
Thank you so much. There's a question. You talked about feeling off beam and calling your sponsor in this meeting. You shared about that. There's a question here about, I fall asleep. And they say, how do you, I find myself in denial, in delusion, and I know something's wrong. How do I get out of that when I'm in recovery and yet I'm off beam? You talk about being off beam. How do I move?
Call your sponsor. That's it. A sick mind can't take care of a sick mind. I have come to understand that. And my sponsor, she's a little crazy. And she calls it like she sees it, which is someone like me needs. I put off calling her for 2 days knowing that I'm just off the beam a little bit. Why? Because I'm taking my friends' inventories and they're not in the room with me. I'm in the shower and I'm taking their inventories. And I'm pissed because I know this sponsor lady is going to tell me I have to write an inventory. Don't want to, have to. And my little girl is just like this. Now, will I do it? Absolutely. Will I feel better at the end? Yes. Will I grind my teeth and make funny faces at her while? Yes. Will she tell me to be quiet and may even tell me to shut up and just do it? Yes. And will she probably tell me to do it right in front of her at the kitchen table? I hope so. I can't fix myself. And here's the other thing. I don't know if any of you do this, but this is one of my happy little tricks. I'll go do a survey amongst people to see if I'm right. And you know what? I may get the majority of people, because I know how to frame a question given my career. I might be right, but I'm still not happy. And I have to make a decision. Do I want to be right or do I want to be happy? Because oftentimes they cannot coexist. And being right, there's nothing about it except feeling going. You remember all those character defects I told you way at the beginning, superior, judgmental, you know, I don't need to remind you. They all come up like whack-a-mole. They'll all pop up. So I'm off the beam. I know it. I'm having conversations in the shower and I'm the only one in the shower. That's always the first sign. And I'm feeling irritable and restless and a little discontented. I just came from a beautiful week in Puerto Vallarta, Mexico. Why should I feel that way? Right? Lucky me, get to call the sponsor lady. And now I've said it again. All right, next question.
Yeah, thank you, Barbara. There's a question here. What step did you complete to have relief from obsession of food?
Oh, the first step. My sponsor had me do write my food history, how I used and abused food, and when did I first realize it, and give her. She let me write a novel. She was good for that. And I wrote my food history, and it was like seeing it on a 8x11 piece of paper. It had a beginning and an end, and it didn't take over my life quite as much anymore. And then, so that was the first level of relief that showed up, because she got to say, oh, I did that too. Oh yeah, you did that? I thought I was the only one that did that sort of thing. And the identification showed up, and this was a sponsor who had lost 80 pounds. And so I had the hope, I had the identification, the hope, which are the key components of any meeting of two or more compulsive eaters sitting together.
Thank you. This is a higher power question. How did you find your higher power, and how did you hold on to it over all these years?
I grew up in a faith practice that was very cultural in nature, and I won all the statues and everything and memorized the prayers till 18, left home and didn't practice it much at all, except when I had to be around family. And I had a 911 God. My dad had a heart attack, please save him and I'll do this. If you can get me out of this jackpot, I promise I'll do that. So I had been exposed to a he's watching you kind of God. And then I came into these rooms and I was exposed to this broad spectrum of choices. And on step two, my sponsor asked me to write a want ad. Well, first of all, she asked me to fire my God that I had and to write the termination notice, which I did. And then she contemporaneously, I had to write a want ad. And so in there was the necessity that you have experience with early childhood education and you have a good vocabulary. You know, these were the things that I use humor, but I also said, I need compassion. I need love. I need sensitivity. I need to feel accepted. And those were the things I needed from my higher power. And it was truly, I was still holding on to so many things with the tightest of fists. And you can only hold on so long. And I remember the night after a meditation meeting, I was in tears. I couldn't stand that silence. I couldn't stand it. And my sponsor just put her hands on my shoulders and she said, you can let it go. And I just started bawling. I had that spiritual experience right there at that moment. And my connection with my higher power in those years since has ebbed and flowed. There was a time where I felt completely forsaken by my higher power at 6 years in recovery because of life events that were going on. Forsaken, left alone. They all went to Disneyland and forgot me. And it was only because so many women walked with me during that time that I never was alone and God was always with me. And I know that now in the rearview mirror. It ebbs and it flows like any relationship. It's never perfect every day. It's necessarily present every day. But there's some days I am pissed off at God, and there's some days he's disappointed with me, but invites me back. He always, and he or she, however you view it, always invites me back. And I always accept.
Thank you so much. There's a question in the chat around food-related behavior. What does that mean, is the question. What is food-related behavior?
So if you go and look at the pamphlet about a plan of eating in OA literature, talks about the five different parts of a plan of eating. There's the when you eat. There's the how you eat. Do you use utensils? You know, where you eat. Do you eat in front of the television, standing up, hiding? There's the why you eat. For me, that one is about I want to have good fuel for my body so that I maintain clarity of thought, so that I better know my higher power's will for me. And then there's the what you eat. So the food behaviors were me eating peanut butter with a finger. Well, then I graduated to a spoon because it carried more. And then I realized that's a food behavior, eating out of and not putting it on a plate. By the way, there's no more peanut butter in my life, but that's just an example. Standing at the counter, that's a food behavior. Eating in the car and throwing the wrappers in the back, Meals on Wheels, that's a food behavior. Eating so fast that I am done almost before anyone picks up a fork at the dinner table. Maybe put your fork down every once in a while, engage in conversation, Barbara, a food behavior. What were my compulsive food behaviors that were aiding more food getting in? Was I hiding when I ate? That's a food behavior. I really encourage you to look at that OA pamphlet, A Plan of Eating, and it talks about it even in more depth.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you. The last question is around those angry sponsees. You talked about angry, coming in angry. How do you sponsor someone who is so angry?
Oh, just like you sponsor someone who is an introvert and stuffs all of the anger inside. Yeah, just go ahead and write your food history. Tell me about it. God damn, I can have to do that. I know. But you asked me to be your sponsor, so go write your food history. Don't engage. Just go write your food history. I love you. Go write your food history. Have them read it out loud to you. Share your experience. Start to create the relationship. And then you do step two and say, tell me about the higher power you have in your other program or that you have in your life. And then have them write about it. I start them writing early, very early at the beginning, so that when it comes time to do their fourth step, they have so much practice writing, it's a nothing burger for them to do it. But anger is a substitute. I'll tell you what it was for me. It was all about feeling in control. When I was angry, I could control things, or so I thought. What it meant was that I was feeling out of control and powerless. It's just the opposite of powerless, you know, the apparent feeling of powerlessness, and using it to try and control my environment. If they're being angry with you, just give them a writing assignment, send them away. Don't be afraid of anger. There's no bullets in anger. If they're asking you to sponsor them, say, okay, here's what we're doing. This is what I've done. I'm not going to ask you to do anything I didn't do. I never had to do this in AA or NA. Cool. But you're still eating. So why don't you go do it? I have a real strong personality. So it's not as challenging for me. And I may not understand the perspective of dealing with someone that's angry that causes fear in you. I will tell you, I had three men come to me in OA after 2 years and say, Barbara, we didn't think you were going to make it. You were angrier than most Vietnam veterans I know. And I would go, well, thank you for your support.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much, everyone, for your participation, for your questions. And thank you, Barbara, for your experience, strength, and hope.
Thanks, Joe. According to our seventh tradition, we are fully self-supporting through our own contributions. As we have now moved to virtual meetings, it is important that we continue to be truly self-supporting. This allows Overeaters Anonymous to continue to carry the message to those that still suffer. This month, we are suggesting members look up and donate to their local OA intergroup. Think about how much you normally put in the basket and transfer this amount weekly or monthly. Our next meeting, a reminder that a Design for Living Big Book OA is a daily meeting. We are based out of Melbourne, Australia. Visit our website at www.ad4l.info. In closing, I would like to thank you all for your service and coming here today. By following the 12 steps, attending meetings regularly, and using the OA tools, we are changing our lives. You will find hope and encouragement in Overeaters Anonymous. To the newcomer, we suggest attending at least 6 different meetings to learn the many ways OA can help you. The opinions expressed here today are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. Please remember our commitment to honor each other's anonymity. What you hear here, whom you see here, when you leave here, let it stay here. Let us all reach out by phone or email to newcomers, returning members, and each other. Together, we get better. To close the meeting, will Eva please unmute and read the promises?
I don't think Eva's here, Kathy. How about you read them?
I'll read them. The promises. If we are painstaking about this phase of our development, we will be amazed before we are halfway through. We are going to know new freedom and a new happiness. We will not regret the past nor wish to shut the door on it. we will comprehend the word serenity and we will know peace. No matter how far down the scale we have gone, we will see how our experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. We will lose interest in selfish things and gain interest in our fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. Our whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will leave us. We will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle us. We will suddenly realize that God is doing for us what we could not do for ourselves. Are these extravagant promises? We think not. They are being fulfilled among us, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. They will always materialize if we work for them.